Ellen, last night you were reading the new poems from your new and selected poems messenger. That featured poems that were made up of long sequences of poems. And you were talking a little bit about that, about the nature of those sequences and what has led you to be involved with them. And I just wanted to ask you a little bit more about why these sequences have interested you and what you believe you can accomplish with them that perhaps is different from the short poem.
I've always been a formalist, not a neo-formalist, but a formalist, which is to say that one of my primary concerns has been the thing made and how it is made. And that may be because I came to poetry from music, so that was sort of my background and my big interest. And I had written early on, I'd written poems that were in sections, but that's not the same thing as a sequence. A poem in sections, what it does is that a section break, it's sort of like a triple stanza break to just give you more space. But really the poem itself is ongoing, it's a single unit. I remember very clearly when I was lucky enough to have a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1978, I used the money for childcare and to finish off this room that was what they call a dry attic. It was just an empty room over the garage in my house in Vermont. I started writing a poem, and the poem had these two elements in it that I couldn't reconcile. It turned out that I could save it and became a poem that I published then called Talking the Fire Out. It had the two sort of thrusts to the poem. One was this tradition in the South, this superstition or holistic or however you want to believe in it, about people have a gift, if you burn your hand, they can talk the fire out of the hand. So I had that. And then I had snakes. I've always had a lot of snakes in my poem. I grew up with dangerous snakes and crawl right in there. And then I had this about talking the fire out. I realized at the time that earlier in my writing life, I would have divided that into two poems because of the kind of size of the unit. And again, because of that formal concern. I could take, you know, the talking the fire out, write one lyric poem that would focus on that, because the advantage of the lyric is really a kind of fierceness or intensity. And that's what I would have done. Because I had this grant, because I had this room, I had all day long. And so I thought, I should just really see if I could get these two things in the same poem. And the most practical way to work on that would be to work on these sections, but not think of sections in the same way. And to think about sort of braiding these two elements of the poem and what that might require in terms of enough that would be continuous and enough that would be variation. So that if you work in a sequence, then you can vastly change things. You can change the tone incredibly. You can just, as though it is another poem. And so you can have these different pieces, and then you also have the interest or the pleasure in how you arrange them. You know, you can take six pebbles and the sort of order in which you put them. And this contingent to that is going to be very different than if you have this other thing that is contingent. And so that's really where it started with that one poem. I think that that is what ultimately has intrigued me and kept me doing them. I swear off periodically, I say, enough of that, all these poems look alike and they've got all these numbered sections. But I don't have a narrative sensibility. I have learned how to use a narrative structure, tell a continuous story that has beginning, middle, end, that has some sort of movement through time and has actions with consequence. So I taught myself how to do that, but I'm not drawn to that. I'm really drawn to those crystallizing moments of greatest intensity, of complex emotional field. That's what I'm drawn to. That's lyric sensibility. The sequence gave me a way to bring more of the world into any given poem. So I continued to play around with that. Between the time that I did Talking the Fire Out, then my next big project was the narrative one, figure out how to do that. And then the other thing that sort of happened to me was after I wrote Lotus Flowers, that has all those narratives in it, I had a kind of anti-narrative fit. And for about 2.5 years, I wrote nothing but fragments. They were lyric fragments. I wrote about 80 some of them. And they were just middles. They didn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end. They were just middles. And I came to think of those as etudes, or what painters do, where you paint the same haystack every single day. What changes is the light. And I thought, what would change for the poet? It probably would be tone, that you could have the single subject. Tone would change, and then it could just be short. I eventually went back to writing full-length poems. Then there was a question of what I'd do with these. I wrote some introductory poems and ran them sort of as variations on a set of themes. And it's another way of thinking about sequence. Then the next one, the big one, was Kyrie, because what that is, it's a group of lyric poems that are similar to one another, so that any kind of variation or surprise or change has to come in the arrangement from beginning to end, but working with these different pieces.
We are having a really interesting conversation about an activity with which many of the people in this room who are listening to you are either fully engaged right now or will be engaged shortly, arranging a book. But you had the unique experience here of going back to other books that you have previously already spent a great deal of time and effort arranging. And now you have the new task of selecting the poems from the previous books for your new and selected. And you were chatting with me a little bit about some of the struggles and the surprises that you came across in that.
Mm-hmm. It is a related question, because once you write those long sequences, you kind of stuck with that then. So instead of seven reasonably short poems, you now have this long thing. And if you have a bunch of them, this can be problematic. In other books, like in The Two Trees, where I had those three sets of variations, those were little sequences within a given book. So what happens if you say, okay, Two Trees was, you know, I don't know, 60 pages, something like that. So now you're going to select from it to have just a kind of sample representation in a selected poems, and you're going to boil that down to 25 pages. So which 25 pages do you do? As soon as you say, oh, well, I have to put the sequences in, well, that could be 20 of your 25 pages. It's also a problem if the thing made is a whole book, which I think it should be, so that there's some sort of structure or some ordering to it. Let's say 18 pages that exist in sequences before, that was part of 60 pages, and now it's part of 25 pages. You see right away how the proportions automatically change. So that was one problem that I had to deal with. And also then the question of, well, what do you do with a book-long sequence? And I thought for a long time that was going to be the hardest problem. I put it off for last. I really thought probably I'd either have to put the whole thing in there, and I don't like that, because then it's way out of proportion to the rest of the book, or not put anything. When Phil Levine did his selected pretty soon after A Walk with Thomas Jefferson, he didn't include it. And I can see how one would just decide not to include it, because you've worked very hard to have this thing that's 55 pages long. Kind of don't want to tamper with it. But the others, I thought, oh, this would be great. Go back to that first book and you only have to save about 8 pages out of it. Pick 8 poems out of, you know, the 55 pages. Great. These I can live with, and then everything else disappears. But you go back and you pick out those 8 poems, and again, the context changes, the relationship one to another changes. And sometimes they didn't always sit well together. Sometimes by compressing like that, it was the repetition and obsessiveness of the concerns was too big. With other books, I found that there would be, oh yeah, keep this one, keep this one. And the poem didn't fit with all of the others. All of a sudden, here's this vastly different poem. How does that hang together as a section? I found that so much harder than I thought it was going to be. I thought it'd just be your greatest hits, and you could ask, you know, 5 friends. I tried that, and they didn't agree. And there was no help at all. Made it worse. Because then I end up with 30 poems. They've cut it from 50 to 30. This doesn't help. So it took me a long time to get rid of my own a priori notions about what it was going to be, and to go back to the thing that I truly believe, which is that when it gets down to it, you're really making a very large poem. You're making it in a different way, because now all the stanzas have been written, and so you're looking to see what is their best relation one to another. And the thing is hard is when you do it for 240 pages and your only experience has been doing it for 60 pages. So just to hold all of that in your mind I found exhausting. But once I realized that there was going to be no shortcut, and that was really what I had to do, then there was this sort of excitement on it to rearrange. The first section opens with a poem that was buried in the middle of my first book. I didn't know from when I wrote the first book that this was going to be a recurring kind of focus. Now it opens what has to be this whole 240-page book. The poem that opened my first book is now the last poem in the first section, because I need that to sort of move from this overall concern to a more particular concern. The poem that opens the second section is a long poem, the longest poem in my second book, longest poem I had ever written, 3 pages long, and now that opens the second section as a way of sort of declaring something different. So it's the same kinds of things that you think about in a single poem, even a short poem, in a section poem, in a sequence, when you're saying what goes first, what goes next, and how is it radically different if you change that. So once I gave myself over to it, it turned out the hardest one to do was The Lotus Flowers, which I thought was going to be the easiest. It was the hardest one, because it seemed that that book was a narrative project, but what I had in the original book, I had other kinds of things. I had a context for it that had shorter poems and other kinds of poems. When I picked out those narratives, like, how many poems can you write about this farm in Virginia? You know, and then what do you do with Dancing with Poets? I came this close to leaving Dancing with Poets out, because it just did not go well with other things.
One of your best-known poems.
Yeah. But that now, it's in a different place, and in order to include it, I had to include 2 other poems that were not on my list to include, because I had to lead up to it, I had to lead away from it. That used to end The Lotus Flowers. This section now from Lotus Flowers ends with the title poem, Once House. So all of that done, then I had saved for the end. It was the easiest one to do, and the reason it was the easiest one to do was because it had a narrative structure. And so I could just think like a novelist and say, which of these minor characters do I leave out? I had the thing, there was a little bit of tinkering within that, of, you know, flipping a couple of poems, or this one will come earlier, this one, to move it along faster. But to make that arc, set of 55 pieces, make that arc with 35. That was the easiest to do. I have far more poems in the selection from Shadow of Heaven than I thought I would do. Here's the problem with the sequences. That has 2 long sequences in it. One of them 15 pages, one of them 17 pages. And I didn't want it to be only that, because the new poem section opens with the sequence, the feeder, right? So I felt I had to have some short poems before, then I put the 2 sequences together, unlike the way it is in Shadow of Heaven, and then I just felt I had to end on something else. I had to end on some short poems. So in order to do that, it ended up a longer section. All of this just to say that, you know, I sat there for days and weeks and did it abstractly, and did it with lists, and did it with, oh, and this, and I want, okay, 10 pages from the first book, 15 pages from the second book, 20 pages from the third, you know, because I love that kind of thing. I love pattern. I love those formal arrangements, and form exists apart from what the form serves. But to do that is very dangerous. So my advice to you when you start doing this, first go through all the poems and say, this I can make 2 piles, this I can live with. This goes into the library here at VCU, and in 30 years, I'll be embarrassed, but this is where I am right now. And these others, just not. Either you tried something that was Ashburyan or something, and then you said, I'm not Ashbury, I'm not going to go in that direction. So you make the 2 piles. Once you have the first pile, you have to love them all equally. Don't do that abstract thing, which is, I should open my manuscript with my strongest poem, and then I'll end my manuscript with my other strongest poem, and then have a muddle in the middle. Don't do that. Love them all equally and say, these are all my poems. Now, what is the arrangement that will show the poem in its best light, which is to say, allow the reader to come to it without bias. Allow the reader to be surprised by it and not think, oh, bird poem, another bird poem. I always use for the other books, and I recommend to you, an ironing board, especially since people don't iron anymore, because you can put that up and leave it up. And that's a way that you can lay out all the poems so that you constantly see just enough of the poem. If you're looking at a list of your titles, you forget. what's actually on the page. You line it up with the ironing board, then you really can see first this poem and then that one and then that one and then that one. And what if you rearrange that just a little bit? You take out that second poem, you try another second poem. What does that do? What kind of art does that? And if you do it on the ironing board, you can just leave it up all the time. You don't have to clear your dining room table or anything. It's just there, and every time you walk by it, then you can think, okay, if I move this one there. It's a formal exercise. The difference between doing that and what you've done all along with your poems, it's just that it's all written. So it's more like moving around stanzas rather than moving around two stanzas so you can write a third one. And you just have to deal with whatever is there, very concrete, palpable.
We all are introspective enough as we write an individual poem. That's plenty of introspection. I know that it can feel burdensome sometimes to return to work and rather than ask questions about the work, ask questions about yourself. But inevitably, when you're putting a book of new and selected together, you're going to be forced into self-reflection. What kinds of things did you feel like you ran across, comfortable or uncomfortable, as you look back at your first book and Plainkin and came along through the development that you had and ended up in Shadow of Heaven and then the new poems? Did you notice an arc of development or anomalous moments in that story? Or?
Very frequently, a first book is a kind of an anthology, where you've been, what you've tried. There are some books that are exceptions to that. If you think of something like The Lost Pilot, that is tightly unified in style, in formal choice, in tone, in everything. Of those two categories, mine was very definitely that kind of anthology thing, because you know my first book was published in 1976. So I'd been writing seriously and working on poems for 12 years. Some of those poems in the first book were poems I wrote in 1968. Some of them were poems I wrote in 1974. I was already kind of a different person by the time I finished that book. Well, the main thing that struck me in going through it, I wish I knew then some of the things that I know now, just in terms of the tools that you need, ways to solve problems, craft. And where that struck me the most was with lineation. That was the most painful thing to see because I've always written off my ear. And so I was always paying a huge amount of attention to lineation, to line breaks and stanza breaks. And I thought I knew what I was doing then. I did not know what I was doing at all. And so I'd go back to some of those places and I'd think, why did you do that? That's where I was very tempted to make changes. And a couple of times I tried that. I wasted a whole lot of time by just thinking, oh, well, I can certainly fix that. No, the whole thing will unravel in your hands. The point is, it falls and falls on trees and houses. I mean, that's just egregious. Why would you do that? I can move that. I mean, I shouldn't have a line break after it. This is horrible. I'm going to change that. I tried changing it, and then I saw that I had very flat lines. Both of the two lines were very flat, and that was probably why. Then I thought, I'll just jazz it up with this severe enjambment. So if seeing that kind of thing, I wish now it turned out, I found out at a very late date that for Norton, they wanted it all computerized. So I had to have it scanned in. This made the problem even more because if I knew enough about computers, I would have told them to just make a, what is it called, PDF, the thing that you can't change. The guy, I paid this guy to scan this in so I'd have it all on the disk. And he said, well, do you want PDF? I said, what's PDF? And he said, well, do you want to be able to make any changes on it? I said, of course, yes. What the computer did was to treat it as prose. So I got all of these poems from all of the books without lineation. So I had to go through and restore the lineation or reconsider the lineation. And I thought, okay, here's a chance to learn something. Let's see if you can do it without looking at the books. And that was where I caught it. You see, that's where I saw places then. I thought, well, surely this is where I put the line break. That was not where I put the line break. But as I say, the places where I tried to undo it, then the poems just really came apart in my hand. And this also happened when I was trying to solve some problems with the structure of the individual sections. Then I would say to myself, okay, you weren't going to use X poem because you hate that middle stanza in there. It feels clumpy to you. So just fix that stanza. This didn't always work either. They ended up being three of the old poems, said I. Enough that you would say, oh yeah, I see that she revised that one. Otherwise, no.
You know, you mentioned that snakes come into your poems. For me, that happens most notably in The Lotus Flowers. It's a poem that I teach often and use it as emblematic of a number of different things. One of them is you handle the most powerful and frightening moment of the poem almost offhandedly, which is, I think, quite studied and actually is part of your character as a person and as a writer. But also, it reminds me of the way that Flannery O'Connor handles violence in her story. And we all know no writer would dare to be more violent than Flannery O'Connor can sometimes be. But when people show up with guns in her stories, she just says, they all had guns. That reticence and care and stringency in your work is something that I think goes way back in you. I mean, I think it comes out of your origins as a poet. I wondered if you would comment about that, because the moment I'm talking about, of course, is the moment when the girl goes to fetch water, puts her hand into the water, and notices, almost offhandedly, that curled near her hand is a snake in the water.
I think one thing, again, that is a poem that I wrote when I was trying to learn how to do a narrative structure. And this was learned, this was willfully learned, that you've got to move through time and you have to have actions that have consequence. I have no interest in those things. If I'm going to move it through time and the importance of those actions, I have got to get the person from here over to here. I don't like doing that. And one of the reasons I don't like it, first of all, I don't care about it. I don't notice enough detail about it. It doesn't seem to matter to me how they got there. I don't care. I want to get to the next sort of charged moment. And I also don't like it because one of the things that I learned in trying to write narrative is that you have to use a whole lot of prepositions. And every time you use a preposition, you are writing an anapest, at least. You're throwing into your line an extra unstressed syllable. I would rather have the overloaded line, where if you've got 10 syllables, let's make 6 of them stresses, let's make 7 of them stresses. That's a way to intensify. So if you've got, you know, a 10-syllable line and you only got 3 stresses, it's flat. So one of the things in writing the narrative, I had to write along a line, because you chop that up into short lines, man, you are really in trouble. So then James went down the street and into the coffee shop and sat on the stool. This is about as boring as it can get. So the best you can do is to put it all in one line so that you have the momentum of the line. James went down the street into the coffee shop and sat on top of the stool. You get at least that kind of movement in it. It seems to me that I was always looking at places when that could be elided, when any of that could be elided. One of the things that you can use is you can use the camera eye. If you've set up the point of view of this speaker girl who goes then to get water, so you have to do that, right? And here she goes, she's leaving the other ones behind, blah, 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 blah. Go down, take bucket. Boring, this bores me. This is the work of it to try to do that and keep that crisp. But then once you get there, you've set up the camera eye, you can just roll the camera. So she puts her hand in the water, she looks at the hand, then she can look at the next thing, then she can look at the next thing, then she can look at the next thing. I think that that's just a lyrical impulse. If what the eye sees is something violent, or if it's something ugly, or if it's something whatever, that's what the camera sees. But in going back to the poems and looking at them, the thing that struck me about The Lotus Flowers that I had never seen before until I took these poems out and I was looking at the handful of them to put together is that 8 of the 10 narratives that I plan to use the past perfect participle. Having been the farmer's daughter, she didn't want to be. There it is, right in the first line. Feast day. Having killed the hog, having hung it up by the heels, having done all this, having done, I mean, there is a whole catalog on the past tense. The one where the father poisons the dog. The dog lay under the house, having crawled back beyond. It was in every one of those narratives. Now, I can explain that, you know, kind of semi-logically and say that these poems and the effort to write narrative was really an effort to write elegy. That's what that is. It was going back to a previous time, writing out of that previous time that's gone. But this is a problem when you put them all together. I tried to take some of them out. Well, can I just drop that one? Can I just use something else? Couldn't I just open the poem? A farmer's daughter, she didn't want to be a farmer's wife. No, no. Had to be having been. But that was all of that past and the weight of the past. The danger is the reader catches on. So here it is, you're doing it again. So then each subsequent poem becomes a pallid, you know, pulling it off the presses after the other one. Did I really answer your question?
Well, the other thing I was going after was...
We got way away from snakes.
You did great. I'm also interested in, I suppose I was talking a little bit about origins of that reticence to be showy. A poet who is so strongly interested in what I'd call lush musical effects, you have in your poems constantly a tension between that beauty and intensity and luxuriousness and the standards you seem to be holding yourself to that I would guess, I'd just take a stab at and say, for me, they come out of Marianne Moore and Elizabeth Bishop, poets who refused always to be trashy. They never allowed themselves to be obvious or exaggerated or willfully emphasizing the dramatic moment in excess. They never did that. And that's something I never find in your poems. Is there an origin of that?
I think it really comes from music. If you're going to play Chopin, let's say, have you seen performers that lift their hand up like this off the keyboard? Very dramatic gesture, isn't it? This is very dangerous. Take your hands off the keys. And also, technique is there always to serve something else, and the something else in music is expressiveness. That's what it's for. You don't go out and say, look at me and how I can do arpeggios. You practice those arpeggios over and over and over and over and over again, so when you get to a passage of arpeggios when you're playing Chopin, you're not thinking arpeggios, your fingers know it. It's like Larry Bird, go out and take 1,000 foul shots every day. So then when you actually get up to the line to take the foul shot, you're not thinking, oh, what is my technique, how do I do this? You put it in the muscles. That's really more where it comes from. If, as a reader, you see the hand of the poet, that means the materials of the poem cannot work on you. And I want them to work on you. I want to pick your pocket. I want you to see what I saw. I want you to feel what I felt. And if you're constantly aware, you won't. And I think I have a greater chance at recreating or fixing the world if all of that stuff is serving some other purpose. Although, certainly then, when I started writing poems, I was very drawn to poets who did that. And I was very drawn to that kind of restraint, starting with Justice, I would say, Bishop, and, you know, a number of other people, rather than the more sort of forthcoming poets, whom I've also come to love. You find your tribe. It's not that you want to emulate them. You just go, I belong to that tribe.
I just had a question about Kyrie. And it's a question about how you go about researching poem or a sequence such as that, and maybe even what the dangers of research are, where do you stop? And I've noticed increasingly over the past few years that maybe it's because of the internet, and you know, if you wanted to write a poem about alchemy, you could just call it up on your computer and you have all the information you need about alchemy. You don't even have to go to a library. And how did you go about trying to think about the historical period?
First of all, this was not a designed project. I did not set out to write a sonnet sequence. I did not set out to write a sequence about the influenza. I was interested after what happened with Two Trees, with those tonal variations. When I put the book together and I saved about 24 out of the 88 and put them together, I noticed that here I was doing this project 2.5 years, you know, writing nothing but fragments, tone was going to change. There was a tone missing. There was no irony. It seemed to me, a 50-year-old woman who has no irony in her makeup, that this was very unseemly. I was much too earnest, and I thought, this is the next thing you need to learn to do. An ironic view, which really says there is no truth to be found, that says these two things are there in equal weight to be seen. So I thought, okay, let me see if I could write a persona poem from the point of view of someone whose circumstance is so that if they didn't have an ironic view, they would shoot themselves. And what popped into my head was this country doctor that my father used to tell stories about, the person who delivered him and for whom he was named. And so he used to always tell the story about Dr. Gilmore Reynolds and how he came around during the epidemic, came around on his horse. There was nothing he could do. He had no way to treat it, and that was true of most things, nothing to do. So he would come in and he would tell you what you had, and that was about all he could do. And I thought, now that guy, he would have to have an ironic view of the world. So that was my interest in the epidemic. What? It was an interest in tone. What tone? How would he approach the world? How would he think about it? So I wrote a longish, I don't know, it was about 50-line poem from his point of view, and that was it. I had no interest in the flu. None. Then the next thing that I happened to write, I had been wanting to write for a little while. My father's mother died in 1914 in childbirth, before the epidemic. The epidemic started, you know, 1917, 1918, right in there. So it was all before that. He was the oldest of five, and he was eight. What happened then was that my grandfather farmed them all out to relatives. My father went to live with his aunt and uncle, who were 19 and 18. He lived with them until he was 12, while my grandfather looked for a maiden lady to marry, and he married my father's stepmother, Miss Sally. And then in the fall of 1918, they brought them all back together except the baby. They left the baby where she was, and they brought all the other children back. So when my son turned eight, I had this moment of astonishment when I looked at him on his birthday. Now, you all have this. You have data from your family that you've just known. I mean, you've just known forever. We'd go by that grave every Sunday. My father would go out and he would stand by the grave and he would weep, you know, his mother's grave. So you know that. That's just a given thing. But it has not registered on you what the feeling experience of that would be. That was my case. And when I had a child, this is my second child. The first one was a girl. When I had a boy and he turned eight and I looked at him and I thought, Jesus Christ, this was the age my father when he lost his mother and when he was sent away to live with teenagers for 4 years. And I was stunned by understanding what that was and how that, of course, shaped all the rest of his life, everything that he was. So sometime after that then, my son was born in 1976. So he turned eight then in 1984. In 1992, then I sat down to write this poem from the point of view of a boy standing by the bed when his mother's dying. And I thought to myself, you need some real constriction on this. You need something that is going to keep this thing from like blowing out of the water. So I thought I would write a sonnet. So I did. I wrote a sonnet, point of view, boy is standing there looking at the mother. Mother is dying. I wasn't going to write a sonnet sequel. I was just going to write the one sonnet. And then because I write very slowly, some time goes by before I write anything else. And I had this kind of aha moment, which was a realization that during the epidemic, that was a time when my father's experience was repeated over and over and over. So then I had in mind to write one of my little shorter sequences, which is about six or seven sonnets. And I thought, okay, this would be good to have the form. And if I could have seven of these, where it is the same experience over and over and over, and I have seven different speakers who speak it in the same form, I got a little sequence. So I wrote that. I thought I was done. I had no interest in the epidemic. I thought I had no interest in the epidemic. Turns out that I've written a lot of poems that deal one way or another with the impingement of the individual on community and community on the individual. You can define community however you want to, family, larger than that. But that has been something that I have always been drawn to. And this was kind of perfect dramatic situation for looking at that. Time goes by. My editor keeps saying, I really like those poems where everybody's coughing and dying. Why don't you write some more of those? And I was saying, who wants more of those? Again, the possibility to see, okay, how far can you extend a sequence? How many of these can you have? Not looking at variation, looking at alike, 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 alike. How intense can you get that way before your reader runs screaming from the room, or before the poems become imitations of one another? So I got up to about 15, and then I thought I truly was done, truly done. And they were all completely lyric in that they were at that moment of the worst of the epidemic. Everybody in extremis, absolutely, 14 lines in extremis. That's where they were, 15. I went up to Idaho to do a week in Idaho, Moscow, Idaho. Not a lot to do there. So I was staying in this motel, and I was doing a class every day, and they have a very nice library there, and I live out in the country, and this is before internet stuff, right? So I thought, I'll go over to the library. I probably should find out something about this epidemic before I publish these 15 poems, you know, and say, oh, this is what the experience was. I better go do some research. So I went over to their library and did this big search, and I found out that there wasn't anything. There was one article from the National Geographic that was published in the 50s that had some pictures of everybody wearing masks in San Francisco. And there was one book by Alfred Crosby, historian. So that kind of intrigued me then. Then I had another kind of level of interest, which was, why didn't people talk about this? So then I really got the kind of research bug, and I thought, let's go investigate. So I read a lot of World War I history, and because I had enough information from Crosby. For instance, twice as many American soldiers died of flu as died of war wounds. So you go look at the, you know, descriptions of the battles. They don't mention the flu. It's just not in there. Well, what about this great flowering of American letters in the 20s? All those people lived through it, right? So I go and look there, not there. Even the great memoirs, Goodbye to All That, he got it. He was sent back from the front. Graves was sent back from the front with the influenza, one paragraph. Mary McCarthy, her parents put her and her brother on the train in Seattle because of the dangers of the flu, sent them, they were I think 6 and 8, sent them cross country to maiden aunts in Minneapolis. Then the parents got it and died, and she was brought up by these maiden aunts in Minneapolis. Now, this is kind of life shaping, two paragraphs. That was when I got intrigued about the actual event. And the worst thing that happened to me for a while was the Crosby book, because then I had information, and I wrote some dreadful poems. I wrote about a dozen of the worst, because they were so encumbered by information. That was when I thought I was going to be this historian, and nobody else talked about it, so I was going to talk about it. And they were horrible. Things like 30 million dead and Black Jack Pershing crosses the sea. So I saw that they were awful, and I first thought that was a sign that the whole sequence was done. I said, okay. But I thought what could be useful would be just to read a lot of fiction that was written in the 20s to help me with some notion of idiom, because I really wanted these speakers to be believable. And I thought, okay, I can continue to do kind of secret research to see if anybody refers to it. And then I will at least sort of have in my ear the syntax and what the idiom was. That was by helpful research, was reading a lot of fiction of the time, going back and reread Ford Madox Ford and Willa Cather and, you know, all those people to have some sense of the syntax. I know that that's a very long answer, but I guess some of it depends on, you have to know your own temperament. My temperament is very didactic and dogged. So for me, the worst thing, information that I have to instruct people on, because then that is what I would try to get the poems to honor. And I find this a lot in young people's work that I see. They do the same thing. If you come to the conclusion before you have the discovery of the poem, you ought to be writing an essay. It'll kill a poem. No matter how intriguing this information is that you have discovered, I would say try to imagine it first. Then you can always go back and say, well, I imagined something that couldn't possibly be. I had plastic flowers in a poem, and they didn't invent plastic until the 40s. But I think that all of it ultimately has to be imagined. If you are of a temperament that you can look up something on the internet, and that will start you thinking about something and spur something terrific, go do it. but then let go of whatever it was that you found. Your job is not to convey information to the world. There are other forms of that that are much more efficient than poem. That isn't what poems do.
What I hear through what you just said is the influence of your father and what must have been his isolation, estrangement, what it was like, his involvement with his mother. That just kept pressing. That had its power.
When he would tell it, it was all about Dr. Reynolds, and had Dr. Reynolds came and gave them all corn liquor, and he loved to tell the story because his little moral to the story was, and we all survived. We didn't need a high-tech Western medicine. He's a very superstitious man. But the facts of it, the fact that they were brought back after the 4 years, meant that it lodged in his memory because it was so charged. That's that lyrical power again. It was charged. I didn't know why it was charged. I had not made that connection in any kind of way. But it was charged, the story that came down. And that he told, he'd love to tell that story. He had other stories that he would tell, like how somebody cured their sore throat by putting that finger in an open socket. You put your finger in the socket and you put your other hand on your throat, and then the electricity comes down and just zaps it right out of there.
This probably is the right question, but you were saying that poems don't convey, or poems aren't the best source of conveying information. So what, in your opinion,
what do poems do? They set truth to music. My hope is that somebody would read Kyrie and have some sense of what it must have been like, given that we're in our own epidemic. That's been a kind of interesting thing to see, because in 1995, well, I first started reading them, I guess, around 1993, 1994. Whenever I read them, I would have to give a 5-minute thing ahead of time, because nobody in the room had ever heard of it. It was a pandemic, and at that time they thought it had killed 30 million people. Now they figure it's over 100 million people, but people have heard about it. The reason you have heard about it is because of the other viruses. You have a motivation to think about what it might have been like. Defoe wrote the Journal of the Plague Year, not during the plague. This is when they thought the plague was coming back to London. That's when he wrote it. What a poem can do that Alfred Crosby could not do was to take a person and elicit from them some imagined, felt experience about it. His book is fabulous. If you have any interest in that period, it's just great. And it's full of statistics. And it's like with the Holocaust. You cannot get your soul to incorporate the figures. You can do it rationally. But to feel that, to incorporate it into your being, into your soul, that's the great thing that literature does. It makes us incorporate into our souls experience that is beyond our own little restricted, whatever it is. Isn't that why we read? Isn't that why we love it? You could feel your own being stretch because of that. You've been able to enter through the discipline of the art and through the imagination that is at work there. Then that is your little wormhole. So you go through that little wormhole into this larger experience. Those are the memorable poems. Those are the great poems. You know, these things go in waves, and the particular wave that we're in right now puts a very high premium on being clever. And there's a lot of work that I see in magazines and see everywhere that is terribly clever. You know, you drop out all the nouns, or you take a sentence, you chop it up, throw it all around the page. So I've already passed that fork in the road. Everything else drives us to shut down, to defend, to be narrow, to be self-interested, everything else in the world.
With all the reading and writing I've done over these years, the hunger, I believe, has increased. And when I read Moby Dick again, after having taught it way back in 67, and see all those notes, what that guy knew or didn't know, I can read pretty well today. That ability I want to take advantage of, as well as the urgency to know more soon.
The books you read again after years away from them, they're just completely different books.
Ellen, I've got a question about, you know, you're a poet who's just so steeped in the tradition of American poetry, of poetry in the English tradition too. And on the Flexible Lyric, though, you have a wonderful piece where you talk about a Hickman poem.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder what you get as a writer from world poetry and translation, from writers who don't come from our tradition, and which which of those people have influenced you and meant something to you?
For the same reason, it expands our view of, you know, what the world is, what human experience is. It's very difficult for me because I do love the music of poems so much that to read in translation, I don't care how good the translator is. For instance, I think Pavese survives in even bad translations. I think that he survives because the sort of character-driven nature of those poems is something that can come to you even if you don't have the language that it's in. And also because if you compare translations, then that's another real clue that this might be somebody that you could really study and learn from even if you don't have Italian, because of similarity in the translations. In his case, you know, an attempt to try to have a kind of plain style that makes it possible. Also, as other things get translated, you may not be able to really take in all of the poems by Rilke. I can't. I don't have German. But at this point, now that we have really fantastic translations, you take the Stephen Mitchell, you take the Snow, start there. Those are the biggest. Then you can also find individual poems that have been translated by a whole lot of different people. So you could take, like, Washing the Corpse. You've got a Randall Jarrell translation. You toss that in there. And you look at all the places where it's slightly different. And it's a fantastic way. It's like memorizing a poem. It's a way to get deep inside the poem. So you might just end up, as I say, not having the whole body of the work, but just having particular poems that are really important to you. Rilke has always been very, very important to me, starting with, I first read Rilke in those Herta Norton translations, which are flowery and rhetorical and all these kind of like big gestures. It's only like 20 years later, and then I read the Stephen Mitchell and I go, that was Herta Norton, that wasn't Rilke. This is a way to start, you know, a way in. So I would say that I'd say Rilke, I'd say Pavese.
I've been at work on a translation of the Duino Elegies for a number of years. And when I was at the Virginia Center for the Creative Arts, there was a woman there, a photographer from Vienna. And so I asked her to come and visit my studio so we could discuss the poem. And there was one passage in one of the elegies that was translated wildly differently between all of the translators. And they did not meet each other. It was just an explosion of variety in this passage. So I asked her if she would do me the kindness of reading some passage of Rilke to me aloud so I could hear the sound. And then when we got to the end of that, I had craftily chosen that very passage so I could say, well, what do you think that means? And she looked at me and she said, this is Rilke.
I had the experience last weekend of reading one of my poems in English and in Greek in front of the Greek Orthodox Church. And I'm putting together a book of poems about this little village on the Isle of Lesbos. And I was wondering whether you have ever had the experience of reading an Ellen Voigt poem in another language.
Yeah, I've had some. They were not happy experiences. Well, I shouldn't say that. There was one experience that was really interesting and one that was excruciating. The one that was excruciating was in Germany, and I had German translator. We had decided on the poems ahead of time, so I would do the poem in English and then she would do her translation in German. And I know a little bit of German. I know enough. It was really off, or it was really reductive. The one I remember was from the Two Trees, but with other women, Maud's on the screen, sometimes he hears that. And there's a reference in there to the fox shrieks in the field. And what she translated was not that. It was not that. And so I asked her about it later. I said, you know, my German is really not very good, but how did you translate that? And she said, well, here, you know, we think of foxes barking. And so this was the word to get the bark of the fox. And I said, yeah, but I mean, it's metaphor, right? It's about a relationship. It's about a man's attitude toward women. So shriek is important. That carries a different sound. And she said, well, yes, I know, but owl foxes bark. And I said, well, owl foxes don't shriek either. I mean, it doesn't sound like that it's shrieking. So it seemed to me so reductive and at such a literal level that I found it excruciating. The other time was really kind of interesting. When William Meredith was the consultant in poetry at the Library of Congress, which became the laureateship, right? When he was there, everybody that he invited to come and read, he had a signer, he had a translator from Gallaudet College, who stood beside you and did it in sign while you were talking. So it was immediate and it was in sign. And I thought that that was fabulous, but I couldn't see it. But to know that it was there, that was really vastly interesting to me. And the other thing was the Gallaudet theater group, for each one of us that gave a reading, they did one poem that they performed. I thought that that too would feel sort of reductive, but I found that quite wonderful because that was a translation to another genre.
I had a student in a class at one time I taught creative writing pedagogy. This student taught deaf students. It is an impediment to being a poet to be deaf. There's no way around that. However, what she did was videotape her students performing their poems, and it was a revelation about the nature of what percentage of what we do is performance. Of course, we're doing performance on the page and in sound, and when you take over another element into it, which is visual, an actual visual presentation, that becomes an equally important ingredient. And those poems were extremely effective, and they were genuine poems, but they required that you see them perform.
Right. It's a different form, it's a different genre entirely. But as is the case with drama to begin with, you read a Shakespeare play on the page, there's one thing, but then to have it enacted in front of you, it's a different experience. So that's as close as I ever came. I never tried to translate my own poem.
Thank you very much, Helen.
You're
Thank
welcome. You. Thanks for coming.